Hello, the internet, and welcome to another Cracked podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about parallel thinking, why and how people will come up with the exact same idea at the exact same moment, totally on opposite sides of the country or the globe sometimes even. We're going to look at how people in England were inventing the character of Harry Potter just all over England throughout the 90s. The English countryside was just lousy with people who were secretly inside their cottages, I guess, when they got home from their fox hunt, secretly working on this amazing idea they had for an English schoolboy who discovers he's secretly a wizard, but keeping it to themselves because they obviously didn't want anyone copying off of them. My knowledge of British culture is a little off, but the similarities between Harry Potter and just all the different Harry Potter characters that a bunch of different people who weren't J.K. Rowling invented totally independently of her are startling. I think the invention of the character Dennis the Menace is even weirder. But none of this is going to make any sense to you until we sort of explain what I'm talking about. So let's go to this week's conversation. Hope you enjoy it. So we're going to be talking to Jason Pargin, a.k.a. David Wong. If you've listened to any of our podcasts, you probably know who he is. He's our executive editor, writes on the site as David Wong, one of the most popular writers on the internet. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
And we are also speaking with one of the editors on the site, one of our columnists, Christy Harrison. Hello, Christy.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about something called parallel thinking or simultaneous invention, the idea that great ideas are not these things that come along once in a generation, that you need some super genius to think up. And in fact, I think one of the best ways that I heard it expressed was in a Malcolm Gladwell article talking about the invention of the telephone. Apparently, Alexander Graham Bell came up with his sort of eureka moment, his breakthrough idea for how to accomplish the telephone while he was overlooking a river. And Gladwell said that had he fallen into the river right there and drowned, the telephone would have been invented by somebody else. There were three other people who were making progress at the exact same moment that had the same idea as him at that time, and in fact presented it at the exact same World's Fair. He just had the best presentation, and so that's why we know of him as the inventor of the telephone. But there are all sorts of examples of that sort of thing all through history, pop culture history. And Christy, I asked you to look into this, and you did. You found a bunch of good stuff, good examples.
I think so. But also, I think there's different kinds of ways of thinking of it, because I think that when it comes to inventions and big ideas, there's this progress of moving towards that idea. And it's not that surprising to me that there'll be multiple people working on the same concept at the same time and are working off of the same influences and research and get to that point at the same time. I think it's more interesting when people out of nowhere come up with completely what seem like random ideas, that almost in the pop culture world where it's more interesting to me, where we see two different things come out of nowhere that are the exact same at the same time in the history of the world. We've never seen it before. And suddenly we've got three movies that are this.
Yeah, but I think the point is that those connections are still there. It's just that a lot of times in pop culture, they're invisible. We've got various examples here, but like to somebody who doesn't know any better, if you saw a story about a young, magical English boy going off to wizard school, you would immediately assume, oh, it's a Harry Potter ripoff. But then you start digging and you find, oh no, there's actually example after example after example of this. And so you could say, well, yeah, the telephone was invented because it was a natural evolution of the telegraph and they all knew that they needed voice and so on, and just multiple people all arrived there. But there's so many other instances where it almost becomes magical, and to the point where the creators themselves insist they had to have ripped me off. There's no way we could have both come up with this. But those little, almost quantum connections, those invisible things in the culture that make all of these people have the same idea at the same time, gets almost weird sometimes. It's kind of fun to try to dig in and figure out why the world was ready for this thing to the point that all these different people all came up with it.
With the exact same idea, yeah. And I think it's going to be helpful for people if we just all go and talk about our favorite example right off the top so that they have a sense of what we're talking about. The Harry Potter thing, Jason, is a great example. And you're saying that it's not that they wrote a bunch of books about a magical British schoolboy after Harry Potter came out. They were writing their books totally independently of J.K. Rowling at the exact same time as J.K. Rowling, and hers just came out first or got published first, got noticed first, and the stories are super similar.
Yeah, and it's not even that they were all being developed at the same time, but just, for instance, the Harry Potter book, the first one, came out in 1997. And then at which point J.K. Rowling is immediately sued for plagiarism by a bunch of different people, meaning each person says, oh, this is too similar, only I could have come up with this idea. But then you start tracing it back, and each one of them could be accused of the same thing. So, for instance, she was sued by a woman who claimed she had written a book in 1984, 13 years earlier, called The Legend of Ra and the Muggles. So at Muggles, if you're not a Harry Potter fan, that's a Harry Potter term for non-magical folk. And then she claimed she had a character in another book named Larry Potter, who was a kid with black hair and glasses. Okay, in the course of that lawsuit, it turned out that this was an unpublished pamphlet that J.K. Rowling could never have seen, short of breaking into this lady's house. She was, like, mildly crazy. So then she was sued by a guy who claimed that Harry Potter was ripped off from his book, called The Adventures of Willy the Wizard, which he wrote in 1987, about a boy wizard who goes off to wizard school, and there's a wizard train and a wizard prison and so on. His case was also thrown out because, if you keep tracing it back, it turned out there was a Neil Gaiman comic book in 1990. He probably has the best complaint of all, but it features a 12-year-old wizard with black hair and glasses whose mother had passed away, who he discovers he can do magic. He has a freaking owl for a pet. But Neil Gaiman did not sue because pointed out that there was a comic in 1988 called The Journal of Luke Kirby about a young English boy with black hair who discovers he has wizard powers. And I think Neil Gaiman's perspective on this is perfect because an author, a creative person, understands this better than anybody. Because he just said, look, when I wrote it, it wasn't an original idea. And he says, I think both me and J.K. Rowling are both ripping off T.H. White, who wrote The Once and Future King, which is these 1930s stories that kind of take a young King Arthur, but it's a very Harry Potterish take on it. He's an awkward kid who's discovering he's the chosen one. There's a doddering old wizard who trains him. It's Merlin in those books. And he's like, all of us just decided it was time to modernize that story. But as a creative person, once you start going down that path, there are certain steps you're all going to fill in the same way. The design of the character, the fact that he's always 12 years old or around that age, the fact that he always has black hair and glasses. One of the authors, I think the Luke Kirby one, said he just designed them off his son. But I think in each case, just to guess, they were each trying to make him the opposite of a standard hero. Blonde hair, blue eyes, muscular, athletic. So what's the opposite of all that? Well, he's got to be thin, nerdy, black hair, mussy hair. He's got to be like at the most vulnerable age, not too young so you can't write about him, but he's still a child. There are all these creative decisions that, because all of us writers are familiar with these basic rules of storytelling, they all wind up falling the same way. An average reader would see those and just assume that one became popular and then the rest of us just all ripped it off. But rarely does it happen that way. And that's a good example because even though these weren't all written at the same time, it became clear in every case that the person who did it later was unaware of the one that came before.
Yeah, it's almost like the culture has a gestation period for previous pieces of culture, and people have been thinking on Once and Future King since the 30s. Their parents must have heard it and like told them similar versions of it, or like had them read it at around the same time. They had similar ideas about that when they were kids, and then that was just brewing in the back of their head for like the same amount of time. It's just crazy that they would all have that same idea within 10 years of each other. I was actually surprised to hear you say that Harry Potter wouldn't have worked if he was a young, muscular, blonde-haired kid. I always pictured him as a Billy Zabka type in my head. Thought that was better.
Cobra Kai, yeah.
Christy, you had a similar-ish example of Dennis the Menace that we had covered in an article before, right?
Yeah, we did. The first American version of Dennis the Menace came out in 1951 in a comic strip, I think, is how we know Dennis the Menace, right? A newspaper in a comic strip. And right before, they published a comic with the exact same name in England. And their version, it was also about a bad little boy. The guy who did that version, he was basing it off of this kind of bar song, Dennis the Menace in Venice. And so someone had said, we'll come up with a comic character based on the song, and he did it. And the other one, the American, was based on the illustrator's son. And I think it's kind of the same deal as the Harry Potter idea, because the only thing that connects them is the name, but the idea of a bad little boy that's getting attention, and especially like in a post-war baby boomer time, isn't so strange. The idea of talking about the antics of a child isn't such a bizarre concept, but they both came out at the same time, and that's what's interesting about it, because they have the same name.
When you say they came out at the same time, they came out the same
literally,
year?
The same day.
They came out the same day?
The five most mind-blowing coincidences of all time by our writer, Jacopo. We have this article. I'm going to pull it up.
I think it's Jacopo. I think I called him Jacopo one time before on a podcast.
Oh,
and
you
everyone
guys
was like,
said that. Jacopo. Okay, I'm going to say it right from now on.
Or maybe I'm wrong. It's a mystery.
So, I'm going to read straight from it. On March 12, 1951, Hank Ketchum's Dennis the Menace comic strip hit American newspapers. Okay, so we all know Dennis the Menace, a blonde overalls. And then a few hours before, on the opposite side of the Atlantic, in this issue of the British comic The Beano, they had the exact same premiere comic.
Dennis same Menace. Title.
Yeah, same title. This little boy has black hair. They both have stripes, oddly enough. It looks like the little boy over in England's more of a bad boy than our little blonde one. But maybe that's because, as Jason mentioned, we're all partial to blonde-haired kids anyway. This little black-haired boy, he looks really mean. They both came out on the same day. Similar premise. Both are bad boys. Both are little kids that get in trouble.
I'm just looking. I went to the article you're reading from, and the illustrations are similar enough. They're both young children who look somewhat mischievous and are wearing striped shirts. It's almost a Heathcliff Garfield thing. You would assume that England had just slightly redesigned their version of Dennis the Menace, but that this was the same company or the same creator behind these ideas.
Yeah, you would think so. They just adjusted it for one culture, make it more appealing to one group of people over the other, but they're not. They each came up with the idea independently, and one of them was based on the illustrator's son, that's the blonde one, and the other one, the title was based on a pub song, on a bar song, and I guess his boss told him, create a character based on this song, which was Dennis the Menace in Venice, which I really want to hear at some point. I need to.
You said the American version is based on an actual little kid, right?
Yes.
One of their
yes,
kids who was a bad kid. Thanks, Dad. Make a character about a shittier little kid.
I don't know if he's bad so much. I keep saying it over and over again that he's bad. He's probably not bad. He's just.
Well, he's Menace.
No, he's a sociopath.
Yeah. Was his name Dennis, or was there just something in the.
Oh, the little boy? Yeah, I think his name is Dennis.
That's crazy.
That would suck. Actually create a comic. I have to look it up, though, because I want to make sure.
Yeah, it says that his name was Dennis as well. So they got the name Dennis from two totally different sources. One is a pub song
right. That
is about things that rhyme with menace, right? The title is Dennis the Menace in Venice. It's just nonsense rhyme words, and Dennis happens to be one of the words they came up with that rhymes. And totally on the other side of the Atlantic, a illustrator is having difficulties with his bratty kid who doesn't want to take a nap, whose name is Dennis. Presumably, this guy did not name his son Dennis because it rhymes with Menace in Venice. And he gets the idea to make this comic strip named Dennis the Menace about his son, and they both publish on the same day.
Right.
That's bananas.
That is crazy. But to me, the idea of talking about a child in the 50s who is getting everybody all worked up is perfect, because it was post-war time. This was the biggest concern that people had in their households, was their bad baby boomer children. And finding humor in that for the first time, I would imagine, ever, finding humor in your kids and not having to worry about starving to death at the end of the day, that makes sense to me, that there were two different entities that came up with this plot. It's like a sitcom. This is how we got sitcoms as well. And it's so crazy. But the fact that they were both named Dennis the Menace is crazy.
But that's really a good explanation of where the line is, because for instance, somebody doesn't know any better, you would watch Harry Potter, you would watch a Star Trek reboot and say, oh, well, those are just rip-offs of Star Wars. Here's a kid, he's got a mentor, and he goes on an adventure, because they don't realize that's an archetype. Just as the bratty kid, the Bart Simpson character, the Dennis the Menace, that's an archetype. What I think a non-writer is always confused by is when those really weirdly specific details wind up the same. And that always looks like plagiarism. And it rarely is. The wizard kids all owning, or multiple ones owning, owls as pets. The fact that multiple writers would independently think of an owl as a mystical creature, like a haunted house type thing, and so what creepy pet could he have? And, well, he could be a rat, or it could be this. And they all land on owl. I think in the writer's mind, that kind of makes sense. Dennis the Menace, knowing that you want some sort of rhyming, memorable name for your kid, and there's not that many negative words that rhyme with child names. And so it is still a crazy, crazy coincidence. I don't want to downplay it. It's just in the entire universe of all the things being created, this is something every writer in your life, you will run into this multiple times, where you came up with what you think is the most ludicrous idea anyone's ever had, and then you'll be watching cable and see the exact same thing in a movie that was made 13 years earlier. And you can never convince everyone that you didn't steal it.
Right.
But that type of weirdly specific thing happens a lot.
But the difference to me about the Dennis the Menace example is that they published on the same exact day. So it's not that two people had the same idea around the same time. The oven went ding on their comics at the exact same time, totally on opposite sides of the world and independently of each other. And that's what blows my mind about that. And also the thing I was talking about up top about the telephone thing, the idea that it's not that another dumbass in Texas or somewhere else in the world thought he invented the telephone 10 years later and come to find out there's this Bell fella up north who had invented it already. No, these were two inventors working in the same general area, totally independently of each other, who had their major breakthrough and brought their invention to the same World's Fair. That's what changes it almost from being just a thing about how similar our ideas are to almost this thing that makes you want to believe in yoga bullshit about there being these energies and this collective unconscious and stuff, because it almost feels like we're all tapped into some sort of shared group of ideas. And I don't think you have to necessarily believe in magic to understand that, but just the fact that we are all reacting to the same sets of ideas and the same general conditions, and we're more similar to one another than we give ourselves credit for. We like to think that we're a little bit more unique than we might actually be. And so we're coming up with the same ideas because we're all reacting to the same sort of great batch of ideas. Like Christy said, the post-war baby boom happening in two different countries, and that gives two different people the exact same idea at the exact same time.
This one's not a mind-blowing example, but it's a famous one. The thing with Hollywood always coming out with the same movie multiple times in a year, there'll be multiple Snow White movies, there'll be, you know, reboots, and then that one year they had multiple volcano movies.
Multiple
asteroid
movies.
But then, you know, in 1998 was the year they had the two asteroid movies, Armageddon and Deep Impact. They were a few months away from each other, but obviously in movie world, you can't put a movie together in 2 weeks. They had to have been in development at the same time, so there was lots of articles written, because that was an unusual case where those were like the two biggest movies that year. Those were both monster blockbuster productions, and they both refused to move to delay theirs by a year. They insisted on coming out in 1998. So everybody wanted to know, well, who stole whose idea? Did somebody hear that Disney had an asteroid movie in development and then rush one in to try to get theirs out first? And the answer is, Almost certainly not, because that's kind of suicide. Nobody's like, oh, they've got an asteroid movie coming out, let's get one out too. You're just splitting your audience. It's idiotic. But what did happen was in 1994, there was a massive, massive comet impact that made the news on Jupiter. And it actually changed the surface of Jupiter. It made this big red splotch on it. It was headline news. And I remember hearing in church a sermon from a pastor talking about how this was a sign of the end times. These were the signs in the sky and the heavens. It was big news. And so everybody sort of caught comet and asteroid fever around then. And Newsweek, a few months later, did a cover with a comet heading toward the Earth. Can this happen here? And there was a lot of TV news special things about that. That was 1994. These movies came out in 1998. That is simply about how much time it takes to fast-track a project that size in Hollywood. Because obviously, if it came out in 1998, they were shooting it in 1997 or so. You know, it probably greened in 1996. By the time somebody sits down, gets a script together, shots it, you start, you know, directors come in and out, you go different directions with it, you get your rewrites together, and then once you've cast it, you got to wait till those people are free. So, like, you know, Bruce Willis will book a few projects in advance, so the earliest you could get him is, even if you decided in 1994 you wanted to do a Bruce Willis asteroid movie, the soonest he's going to be free to shoot it is going to be a few years later, right? Because he doesn't just drop what he's doing to come shoot your thing. And a special effects movie takes a long time to shoot. So, you know, and there was rumors that maybe one of the writers of Armageddon, he'd shopped the script around to various studios, and that one of them just secretly, we don't want his, but he doesn't have, you know, a copyright on all asteroid movies, let's just make our own. But one way or the other, it's far more likely that that is simply the amount of time after this thing hit the headlines that it took to get the movies made. So once you hear it spelled out like that, it doesn't seem interesting at all. But what people have to understand is that those same connections on a much more minute level are how you get multiple people coming up with the telephone. It's still chemistry, the culture is. And it's all these things coming together at just the right time, and this is how much time it takes them to gestate into a finished idea. How many inventors in the world? How many million or how many hundred thousand? There's a lot of them. And of those, you know, they all saw the same things. They all saw the same needs. They all saw society, the same gap that needed filled, because inventors all sort of think the same way. And so while here you've got a very broad news trend that manifests itself in a movie a few years later, here, you know, with the telephone, maybe a much more subtle thing, and the same thing with Dennis the Menace, is there may have been some much more subtle thing that, like, gave that name a negative connotation. Maybe there was a kid in the news named Dennis where suddenly that became like a stand-in name for a bad kid. I don't know. But it's something where you literally probably could never even dig it up if you tried. But like you said, it almost comes off as the mystical energies that drive the universe, because it winds up working the same way as this collective unconscious, because really that's what culture is. We all talk to each other, and these ideas all live out there, and eventually they'll hit.
Yeah, I like that explanation where it's all mystical and part of the same consciousness and on a whole other level. We don't have to dig down and explain everything away. Because that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the end of the podcast, because Jack has decided it's ghosts. It's the ghosts that give us ideas.
That's not my idea, Kristen.
It's all ghosts, guys.
Yeah, it's all ghosts.
I was saying it almost makes you want to believe something crazy like that, but I like that you guys have selected.
Well, and when I offered that explanation in court, they did not accept it.
Right. This happens so often in LA, and I wonder in movies, and I wonder if it's because the people making movies are all coming up with ideas in the same town, you know? It's not just that the two people who pitched the original ideas for Deep Impact and Armageddon happened to see that Newsweek article. They might have seen that same Newsweek article on the same grocery shelf in the same Ralph's, because they're all coming up with writing, trying to create new ideas in the same town. And I've always felt like the fact that the entire industry is in LA is a really limiting factor in terms of what major blockbuster movies are able to come up with, because All the things that we're talking about, these unique, tiny little details that can suggest you, push you one way or the other, like the name Dennis appearing in the newspaper or something. If we're all working within that same geographic location and seeing the same news stories and getting those same sort of small but imperceptible but really influential ideas thrown at us from the same sources, it's no wonder that this happens so much in movies, that we had White House Down and Olympus Has Fallen.
Olympus Has Fallen. I have seen one of them. I literally don't remember which one it was because I can't match which title. Like, I don't know which of those was the Jamie Foxx movie and which one was the
Channing Tatum. Morgan Freeman. Olympus is Morgan Freeman. The other one is the other one.
It makes you want people to be attacking these projects or these industries in different places where they're having different ideas thrown at them. A lot of the really innovative filmmakers are not working in LA when they first kind of come up with their idea. I feel like the 90s, the Wes Anderson and Tarantino were like working not in Los Angeles, but I could be wrong about that. Just another entertainment industry, Christy, that you brought up when we were talking about this is the word creep being in the title of songs in the mid-90s.
Do you guys remember that? And I looked it up so I could find the dates to see how close these songs were to each other. But I do remember at one point noticing, how are all these songs called Creep? So there were three. There were three songs that came out within about a year of each other. One was the Radiohead song Creep, which came out in 1992, but they re-released it in 1993, which is probably when most of us heard it. And then TLC had a song also called Creep with a totally different meaning that came out, I think, in 1995. And Stone Temple Pilots had a song that was called Creep, and that was in 1993.
TLC was 94, so they were all within...
Was it 94? Within, you know, 18 months of each other, we had three songs, and they were all big songs. And I have been trying to think of how that word could have creeped into the language to make us because these three different genres come up with a song, and I have nothing. I'm going to wait for Jason to explain it.
The amazing thing to me about that story is that Radiohead released Creep in 1992. Nobody gave a shit. Then in 1993, there was something about the culture that was ready for Creep songs because they re-release it in 93 and it's a major hit. And there's three other huge hit songs over the next 12 months. And that's the title, right? Creep, all three of them have the title Creep. And there are different meanings of Creep. Radiohead is saying they feel like a creep, a creepy person. TLC is about creeping, the verb. And Stone Temple Pilots is, who cares? But
I don't know what that one means.
That was probably the biggest hit of the three.
Was it?
I listened to it the other night because I couldn't remember how it went.
Just sing part of it for us so we remember what it...
No, I can only sing the TLC version. And I just go too dirty with that, so I can't do it. But I was thinking also Beck's song, Loser. When did that come out? Is that 94?
Probably around that time, yeah.
No, it was released in 93. I'm wondering if just the kind of the tone shifted in music and the self-deprecating voice came out that kind of made people want to listen to that song. I'm not sure. I have no other frame of reference for this, though, because I can't think of any other pop culture instances where we're getting bombarded with the word in any other context at the time.
No, but I think you landed on it, though, because you had a broader trend of these self-deprecating tone, the grunge tone of I suck and I'm terrible, which obviously it doesn't explain the TLC one, but like for some reason they're like all landing on that word to describe it, because I'm sure those are not the only three songs, right? So that sort of makes sense, and I didn't go back and look up all of the rapper songs about butts. I'd like to think the Sir Mix-a-Lot kicked off that phenomenon, but I don't think that everybody else who recorded butt-related songs after that, Rump Shaker by Rex and Effects, I don't think they were like, oh yeah, we got to jump on this butt bandwagon. I don't doubt that they were all performing their butt songs for years live, and then they just got them out like, oh, we got to get a video for our butt song because of this, we got to jump on this trend. But then these next ones were also hits, and it's like society as a whole is like, oh yeah, butts, yeah, that's right. Society's been around for thousands of years, but just this year we've all decided to stop and appreciate butts. and we were all ready for that for some reason. And weren't there multiple songs called Whoop, There It Is?
No, Jason, there was Whoop, There It Is, and Woot, There It Is. Get it straight.
Never mind then.
Speaking of, though, songs with P at the end, switched with another letter, Woot, There It Is, and Whoop, There It Is, were two nonsense phrases that became titles of songs. They didn't mean anything at that time either. Nobody was going around saying either of those things where I lived. I was like 11 in Ohio. But as far as I know, those were just randomly generated at the same time in separate parts of the country and became huge monster hits because the world was ready for that nonsense phrase to be the title of a song.
But it had to have been a slang phrase that was going around, and then the two different people finally decided to make songs out of it, right? This had to have been something that people were saying to each other.
I like to think not, because that's a stupid phrase, and I like to imagine urban culture being cooler than that.
Let me give an example. Speaking of the butt phenomenon, society being ready for something and then it like manifesting itself in a really specific way. Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes as a brand had been dead for decades. You go like IMDb and like instances of him showing up. You have the young Sherlock Holmes movie in the 80s, 84, something like that. He would show up in like TV movies and things like that. But it's not like James Bond, where we've had a monster Sherlock Holmes franchise for 50 straight years. It had completely gone out of style, and then now we are, in the 2000s, are bombarded with Sherlock Holmes adaptations, big ones. The TV show House, which is a Sherlock Holmes adaptation, I assume most people realize that, it came out in 2004. The Robert Downey Jr. monster blockbuster franchise came out in 2009. The BBC series with Benedict Cumberbatch came out in 2010. And then the CBS show Elementary came out in 2012. So all of a sudden, you've got these four major franchises. So again, not knowing any better, the automatic thing you would assume is that one original person came up and said, you know what, I want to reboot Sherlock Holmes in a gritty, more modern version. And then once that became a hit, everybody else jumped on the bandwagon to cash in. And that's not what happened at all. By the way, there was a fifth Sherlock Holmes franchise that was to star Sacha Baron Cohen and Will Ferrell as Holmes and Watson, and it's one of the rare times when Hollywood was like, no, that's too much. That's too much Sherlock. And they actually killed off the project in 2008 because they're like, this is one too many. But anyways, House started in 2004. That had been in development for a few years and had been developed originally as just an ensemble hospital show, like ER. And at some point in the development, they decided to make it all about one specific guy, and then at some point they decided to make him Sherlock Holmes. So they gave him the name House, Holmes, House, get it, and then named his best friend Wilson for Watson. And then they said they would make it like a detective show where he solves disease crimes the way Sherlock does. Gave him the narcotics addiction, Sherlock Holmes addicted to cocaine, and gave him the pill addiction or whatever.
By the way, sorry, just real quick, you rushed past the Holmes House thing, but that blew my mind. I was not aware of that. I'm simple. I like Sherlock Holmes and I like House. I knew they were somewhat related thematically. Did not catch that. I'm a stupid person. Go ahead.
So anyways, the Sherlock Holmes Robert Downey Jr. reboot, that went into production a few years later. But that had been in development hell for 10 years. Different directors coming on board, different stars coming. You know how movie franchises go. It usually takes 6, 7, 8, 9 years to get something from concept to screen. That's just normal. So it had been in development long before they had decided to go the detective route with House. That was a parallel thing. The Benedict Cumberbatch show, that was announced in 2008, which would have been a year before the Robert Downey Jr. one came out. That one, the writer had written for Doctor Who, and there's a 2005 Doctor Who episode that referenced Sherlock Holmes or in some way took place in the era, and they had the idea of, like, we should do, like, a modern Sherlock Holmes reboot. And then, that, again, just took them a few years. So, again, these are guys working in England. The show House would have been on by that point, but no concept of the movie version of Sherlock Holmes. Then you had the CBS series, Elementary, that came out in 2012, and that, in fact, was just stolen. They actually went to the BBC and asked if they could adapt their Sherlock for American TV, and they're like, nah, we don't want to. And they're like, well, screw you, it's a public domain character. We'll just do it anyway, and you'll get nothing. You won't be involved, and we'll keep all the money. So that one was just a ripoff. But the point being, this is part of a much larger trend, which is the smart person hero instead of the muscle-bound Schwarzenegger-style hero. Because in addition to all of this Sherlock, you also had that show Lie to Me about the genius who could detect people lying. You have Tony Stark, the Iron Man, who's a superhero who's a genius, and you could probably sit here and rattle off 100 others. Because the culture, for whatever reason, in the mid-2000s, was ready for the genius hero. And when you get a bunch of creative people talking about, I want to do a franchise about a genius hero, they would say, well, like Sherlock Holmes, because that's the most famous one. So it manifested itself as the same specific character being brought back a bunch of times. But it was part of the culture at large for whatever reason.
It makes sense that it's the 2000s where we brought back the smart hero because it's the age of information and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and that's what we aspire to be now. So why bother with the big muscle guy when we all want to be rich and smart? So,
but Bill Gates,
that totally makes sense.
Bill Gates was a villain in the 90s. I would not have drawn a connection between Bill Gates and Tony Stark.
But the idea of using your brain to accomplish what you want as opposed to being a action star makes sense.
I mean, obviously Tony Stark is a really old character, but he became a mainstream hit because we were ready for someone to be a geek. What's the guy's name who runs Tesla?
Elon Musk.
Yeah. We were waiting for someone more like that, someone who's cool and would be a rock star geek type. The idea that we create the heroes we're looking for in fiction before there's even such a thing in reality, I guess. I think that the whole Sherlock thing and the Tony Stark thing preceded anyone being like that in actuality. I guess the legend of Jobs kind of grew, but at that time he wasn't considered the coolest person in the world or anything.
Yeah, but and usually like in fantasy wish fulfillment, when we watched Arnold Schwarzenegger or any of those muscle-bound 80s action stars, it wasn't a bunch of muscle dudes in the audience. The whole point is that you're watching somebody who's not like you. But then again, the question then, if you roll back to the invention of when he first became popular in print in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle short stories, why was the culture then ready for a genius detective? And you can look back now and say, oh, well, it was Victorian era, crime was running rampant, you had the first, you know, cities and the first serial killers and that sort of thing, and the public loved the idea of besting that, the savagery with genius, that humans are smarter than criminals, and that this is an example of how the good guys will always be smarter, and that was filling like a cultural need at the time. But so it's just interesting to see it in the span of 5 years suddenly all being brought back, along with all of this whole genre of autistic detectives now with the new, the Hannibal reboot and The Bridge and all these shows where they're not just smart, but they're like socially disconnected, they're hostile to everybody. That seems to be a crucial element of it now. It's not just that Dr. House is a genius, but he's also a dick. And that Sherlock Holmes is a dick to everyone, has no social skills. That almost seems to be more of a part of it now than the genius part, and more important than that ever was in the original Sherlock. We're really attracted to that now, and I'm not 100% sure why that is, other than maybe that's just, again, you have an audience that would love the fantasy that you can still succeed and still be the top without ever learning any kind of social skills. Like, maybe that's all it is. You have a lot of socially disconnected people that's now
right.
The hero.
So disconnected, so seeing someone who is worse at it than you are is comforting.
Because even like Tony Stark, they make this big plot point that he can't relate to his woman or whatever, and that he doesn't have friends, or that he doesn't have real friends, and you know, like they make this whole big point about how Pepper has to perform surgery on him because he literally doesn't know any surgeons somehow. He's ostracized himself from the medical community. I don't know what the backstory is on that, but either way, they really drive home, even though he's this handsome, rich, good-looking guy, that he can't talk to people.
Right.
Because he's like too awesome to talk to people.
Which they've had to invent that as they went, because he is the most fun person. He's really great in social situations, and then they just have to like manufacture this awkwardness that isn't there at all in Downey Jr.'s performance, but they're like, people hate him. He's too rich and charming. And
yeah, he's alone. He's too much of a womanizer. He can't let anybody get close. Any of us social awkward people, this is what we would love to believe, is that what happens is I was just too awesome for them.
Right.
I'm operating on such another level that I'm so involved in my greater hobbies and my side projects that I can't relate to the common folk.
This really took a turn for the sad. This is what we like now.
Well,
this is what we like to watch.
I don't know how poorly that compares to what we like to watch in the 80s when it was muscle-bound guys who would just go around shooting things up and were impervious to bullets. Hey guys, one more ad real quick. By now, you've heard about Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio, assuming you have listened from the beginning of this episode, since they're this episode's sponsor. But did you know that Squarespace is the only website platform that allows you complete creative control without having to mess with HTML codes? Just use their drag-and-drop user interface to snap your website into shape. Of course, because Squarespace is the coolest, if you like using HTML code, you can. You geek. But you can start your free trial with no credit card required. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, use the offer code CRACKED, C-R-A-C-K-E-D. Get 10% off. Squarespace is everything you need to create an exceptional website. Back to the show. I mean, it's obvious why this happens, right? It's we prefer to think that works are influential. Nirvana's Nevermind is influential. It created the grunge movement. We don't have research on that in front of us, but based on everything that we've read elsewhere, that's probably not the case. It's more the really famous works are just opportunistic. I think that one had a opportunistic smart producer who was able to like match their sound up with sort of a radio friendly sound, and that's why Nirvana was the one grunge group at that time that suddenly took off. But it's not one person inventing something that everyone else just sort of builds on top of necessarily. It's that these things are going to take that course one way or another, and you can take advantage of them or not. There was going to be a grunge movement with or without Nirvana.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that the people who were actually in Seattle as part of that music scene, none of the bands that they thought were the best were the ones that emerged from that. And then the fact that like Pearl Jam became the face of it is crazy. Like Eddie Vedder's from California and moves there because it's like, oh, this is where all the record deals are getting made. He just shows up and is like, yes, here's an example of the great music that's being made in Seattle. But that's the way it happens. But that's one reason why there was tension among those acts. But that's a whole other thing. Like, why are there music scenes that happen? That in itself could be a whole conversation about. You go back and these people knew each other in high school, you know, and
yeah, Whoop and Woot, There It Is, actually came out of, I did some research on that in the past 2 minutes, and they came out of the Miami bass scene. So it's this cluster of similar ideas that start building on each other, and that just happens a ton in TV and movies, I think, because a lot of the TV and movies are made in one of 5 to 10 cities around the world.
But even then, I think that's overstating the necessity for these people to be in proximity. Obviously, it's really a part of it, but if you were omniscient, you could look at all of humanity and trace how an idea went from London to New York or whatever via this guy saw a thing on TV, went to a party, had a conversation with this guy went and spoke to a bartender about it. You know, that bartender wrote a letter to the editor in the newspaper, and then that newspaper was read by a guy in New York that triggered an idea, and then he went into a party and told somebody about it. And so that's how you wind up with, like, two different people writing a song with the same title on opposite sides of the planet. These connections are there, but they're invisible. Or as you said, it passing by the same magazine cover or just the same connection clicking in your brain. But some of them are more obvious than others. When the first sexy vampire movie came out, someone had pitched us a video idea of doing, wouldn't it be hilarious, somebody did like a sexy Frankenstein. And then I think Saturday Night Live that next month did it as a sketch, wouldn't it be hilarious, someone made a sexy Frankenstein movie. And then, of course, this month, the actual sexy Frankenstein movie came out.
Right.
Somebody spent $70 million taking that joke because everybody's brain went to right to the same place. Like, okay, clearly we're all going to start doing sexy reboots of traditional Halloween monsters, so let's just list them.
Right. I mentioned this when we were talking about it, but you can see it happen in real time every night on Twitter. When they do the trending topics, I think it's Comedy Central that has the At Midnight show, and they suggest a funny topic. And if you click on the trending hashtag and just watch the jokes, every few seconds you're going to see the exact same jokes come up. And it's because none of us are that original or smart. We just think we're smart. And we see it in the workshop, too. I guess we should explain what the workshop is. But when we're going through our pitches, we see people pitch the exact same ideas, sometimes very close to each other.
Yeah, a lot of the time we'll accept the same pitch at the same pitch meeting from two separate authors and be like, hey, you guys wrote the same article but had different examples of this same idea, so we're just going to put those two together.
Yeah, it's almost always inspired by one story that catches everyone's eye, and then they decide to build a whole article around it. And so it's not that hard to figure out why it happens. But, you know, we'll go for years and years and years, never have a Shakespeare article, and then I think we had one. It was specific to dirty jokes in Shakespeare pitched within a few weeks of each other all of a sudden, and we had to put those together. I don't know. I don't know why people think in the same lines. I don't think it's intentional. I don't think people at all.
No, it's not. Because the way the workshop's set up, and I'm going to back up and explain what the workshop is for the moment. The way the workshop's set up, you couldn't get away with doing it on purpose. It gets glaringly obvious, right? You couldn't fool us because it's right there and it's time-stamped. The fact that yours came in 48 hours later is right there, so you couldn't successfully do it. And a lot of these come in from veteran writers who they're trustworthy. They've written for us many times, and they're always mortified to see what happened.
Right.
But at this point, they're also all very familiar with it because it happens constantly. To explain what the workshop is, the way Crack gets its feature articles, or the vast majority of them, we have an open submission message board where anybody can post them, and then we have a team of moderators and editors. We have the system of reviewing all of them. Everything that gets submitted gets reviewed. And we've been running this since 2007. There are about 140,000 pitches, I believe, in there, something like that, that have accumulated over the past 7 years. So we see all these come in, and they're all visible to everyone else. That's the advantage over submitting via email. Everyone sees everyone else's submission, and it comes in as timestamped, so theft is extremely difficult because we would immediately know who stole it. We could immediately prove when it was posted. So theft is not much of an issue at all. But you see all of this stuff come in one mass, and then we just have this filtering system for reviewing and moving it up to the next step until finally we accept it and pay them money and they write the article. And that's how Crack functions. So you may get hundreds of pitches submitted in a week, and then the editors themselves may review, you know, 75 or 100. And it's when you see that universe of stuff submitted, you start to realize how this chemistry of culture works. The first example I ever remember is in 2009. We'd been operating for 2 years, and a writer had submitted a pitch called The 7 Most Ridiculous Mustaches in History. The prefix of the title was A Mustache Ride Through History, : The 7 Greatest Mustaches in History. 48 hours later, somebody else submitted The 7 Craziest Mustaches in History with many of the same examples. And they were, like, accusing each other, dude, you know, what do you think you're doing? And I was like, what? What are you talking about? 2 years, we had never, ever,
ever had a single submission about the word mustaches.
All right.
We had never had a you could search the forum for mustaches and you would get those two pitches, and they were submitted within 2 days. And they did not just steal some third party's article. They both had the idea of, hey, wouldn't it be funny to just go review the most insane prominent people that had crazy mustaches and just kind of do a humorous review of the history of famous people's mustaches. And within 2 days with each other, those were both posted. Just because of whatever mystical, the ghost that fuels all of our thoughts, according to the religion that Jack follows, decided that, we all need to start writing about prominent historical mustaches today.
I think Adam and I were part of that. We did Most Atrocious Uses of Facial Hair in Music History. I co-wrote that with him, and that was 2010, so we were really late. And I think Robert did one, too, right before, because I remember, hey, that's weird, he's doing one of them.
What Jason and I decided at that time when you pitched it, you weren't a member of the editorial team, so you weren't there for this meeting, but Jason and I rejected the first one because we knew the culture wasn't ready for the mustache article yet, and then when you pitched it, we knew. We had on the board going into that meeting things the culture is waiting for, and it was crazy mustache articles. Jason, do you remember what the one was that kept coming up over and over again? It was kind of the first thing that made me notice this, and then that Gladwell article came out that fleshed it out a little bit. But I think there was one really specific trend that just happened over and over again. I think it was actually in the video meeting, which does come in. Like, we get video pitches through email, so that can't be people copying or anything like that. It's just you're getting emails from 10 separate people with the exact same idea, but I can't remember what the specific idea was.
I can't remember what premise it was either, and I wish I could, because I know exactly what you're talking about, because we got to the point where we were scared of ever accepting one that was sort of close to that, because there would be so many troops who would think that we had taken their idea and adapted it, because we could never convince them that literally six different groups all pitched this exact same sketch idea that had the exact same rhythm and the exact same punchline. The whole what if blank happened or what if blank was identical. It caused great confusion on the calls because everybody's like, we talked about this last week, why didn't we just deliver the feedback? Then it's like, no, that was that group from New York. This is the guys in LA. This is totally different. They just all have that same idea for some reason.
You're right. The same thing happened with the zombie thing, Zombie Twilight. But that was more easy to explain because Twilight was happening, and the first place your mind goes is Zombie Twilight. But this one was so weirdly specific and inexplicable as to where it came from. It was one of those things that whatever they were all reacting to was invisible to all of us. We couldn't figure it out. Yeah, maybe it was they had all read the same opinion piece in the New York Times two summers before.
Yeah, but it was a specific comedy observation that they all thought was unique. It's hard to explain, again, to somebody that doesn't deal with hundreds of pitches. Again, it was a case where we could never approve it because they would all think we had stolen their idea, but it wouldn't be one other group. It would have been like five.
All very talented people, really talented comedy troupes, all having the same exact idea. The one thing that they probably pride themselves on not doing is having run-of-the-mill ideas. There's this theory that this album by a blues musician, Robert Johnson, by the time anybody heard it, he was dead. He died when he was 27. It was just like a kind of an obscure recording, just him and his guitar. He was singing into the corner of an empty room because that's what he needed to do for the recorder to even like pick up his vocals, get needed to echo off the walls in a weird way. But every great rock guitarist who you interview lists that same album as being hugely influential to them. Eric Clapton, guy from Led Zeppelin, like all these people who basically invented rock and roll as we know it, independently of each other, were kind of obsessed with this same obscure blues album. And I just wonder if the thing that we've covered well is that we're all more similar than we might think. And there's this idea of it being time in the early 90s for grunge to just swell up like a wave. But I'm wondering if there are tiny things that are starting those movements that we don't know about. One album that came out in 1981 caused the grunge movement, and we just don't know.
Right, and the people who listen to it as kids had to get old enough to make their own music, there was that lapse where that's how long it took them all to start putting their own spin on it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's also a piece of that, too, where you know when you are part of a genre or a group, you know the right things to say. You know who you're supposed to be listening to or who you're supposed to be watching and who you're supposed to be influenced by. And I think there's a piece of that, too. So once you hear your idol say that, you know, they were inspired by this album, you go to it and it just kind of builds on itself.
Yeah, but by then it's too late because they're your idol, because they're famous. And so you're going back and trying to be influenced by the things that influence them. But the people who are going to be famous when you're a grown up are the people who are building on top of what your idol was playing. I think it's almost worthless to even try and figure out that alchemy. I have that Robert Johnson album on iTunes because I'm a weirdo. I really tried to like it, and it sounds like a guy with his guitar singing on street corner because I'm used to hearing amazingly produced songs. And like, it's just that at that time, they were all hearing something. I've now heard like everything that they built on top of that and like used his riffs and stuff to create. And it's much better, but I do wonder if it's just sort of this pattern of tiny things starting huge waves that then start their own big movements.
I think somebody doesn't know what you're talking about. It sounds a little bit obvious, like we're all just trying to sound like that guy. And I think what you mean is that when these people have that influence and they all each think they're putting their own individual spin on it, their spins wind up sounding the way they chose to mutate it is the same. The specific way we chose to adapt it, that also winds up being similar because on top of having the same source material, their minds all work a certain way.
Right. And they're working with the same technology. They're working with the same other influences.
Even when you think you're turning it on its head, we're all trying to turn it on its head. We're all reacting to the trends. Well, you know, you've got a bunch of TV shows about single dads. Well, I'm going to completely go off the reservation and I'm going to do a show about, you know, a pair of lesbian mothers. Look how edgy I am. And then you realize that you're one of 13 people that pitched lesbian mother sitcoms that year because they all had that same idea. It's not that we're going to imitate this, but that we're going to blow the world's mind. But this is why some of the most unoriginal crap is made by people who set out to be original, because they thought, well, I'm just going to do the opposite of what everybody else is doing. And that's the worst motivation for creating something. It's like, I'm going to do something nobody's ever done before. You kind of just have to sit down and tell the truth and kind of do what you love and then hope that it's different, as opposed to, okay, what kind of story can I tell that's going to be different than what's out there right now? Because you wind up simply writing the same crap that everyone else is thinking, the same thing you just thought will be writing by the time your thing eventually arrives.
And you have to be fast. If you can come up with a spin, you have to be the first one that gets it out in a way that everybody can get to, because you're right. Everybody else is developing the exact same ideas at the same time.
But I don't think you get credit for being the fastest one. Radiohead released the exact same song named Creep in 1991 and in 1993.
That's true.
And that song became a giant hit in 1993 because that was the year that Creep was...
We were ready for Creep.
Yeah, we were ready for Creep. Jason was saying the grunge movement, there were bands that were exactly like Nirvana before Nirvana. I think in that case, it was that they hooked up with maybe the right producer, or the people they ended up working with might have helped them along the way or something like that. But being first is not as important as hitting the right moment, and who the hell knows when that's going to be, you know? It's like you can't cheat the system.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to the Sherlock example. I don't think any of those people sat down and stuck their finger to the wind and said, you know what, I think the culture is ready for like a mildly autistic, socially awkward genius detective. The way when you read about how House came about, that was one of the last decisions that was made, to name the show after just that guy instead of just calling it whatever the name of the hospital was. The way they arrived at it, it wasn't on accident in the sense that they were good enough storytellers and all very experienced writers, but they knew they were making a good show with a good character and all that. But the fact that it became a hit and that suddenly everybody wants this character, like, I don't think any of them were aware of that. And like I said, the guys who did the BBC Sherlock, they're in the BBC, they're in England. So it's like, ah, you know, nobody's done Sherlock in a while. Let's think about bringing that back into a long-form show. That would be neat. But I don't think they thought, oh, you know, the culture is ready for this, man. It's the people trying to jump on those trends that make the crap.
Right.
And I think that Kurt Cobain was just writing about his childhood. I think he was just trying to sound like the punk bands he grew up with, you know, and then on that same scene you had the Pixies or whatever. He was just doing what he loved, and it just so turned out that's what the country needed. But one of the most interesting things about it to me is that when you ask each of these people who made the thing that all became hits at the same time where it came from, and they can each tell a different origin story, like with Dennis the Menace, they've each got their own way that they arrived at it. None of them knew their part in the chemical reaction. They each were just trying to make something they thought was cool, but didn't realize that the reason they thought it was cool was the same reason the rest of the world was going to suddenly love it, because they also were part of that chemical reaction of all these cultural influences and opinions and events that all influence us kind of in the same ways but different ways. So nobody knows their part in it, because if Hollywood knew how to just push a button and catch on to a trend right when it's going to happen, they could just print money. But 90% of the movies they make bomb because they can't do that. They're just guessing.
One way to guarantee yourself a bomb is to try and do this.
Yeah, I, Frankenstein, is going to lose the studio $100 million. And nobody was ready for a Frankenstein with sexy abs. Although, to be fair, I do feel like even a few years ago, we probably could have predicted that that was not.
There was no good time for that.
We probably should not have greenlit that. It seemed like Christy had a ton more examples that we kind of steamrolled her.
Well, my favorite example is so culturally irrelevant that you wouldn't want to talk about it on the show because it would make us sound so stupid. So we all are familiar with The Brady Bunch, which came out in 1969. And I don't have to go back and talk about The Brady Bunch, right? If our readers don't know The Brady Bunch.
Yeah, just give us the times that it was on.
Okay, so The Brady Bunch came out in 1969. A year before that, there were two different movies that came out from two different studios that had the exact same premise. It was two blended families that each of the parents were coming in with 8 kids. And so it wasn't 6 kids total, it was 20 kids total. The two movies were called Yours, Mine, and Ours, which was remade in the 90s, and With Six You Get Egg Roll, which was a line in the movie. So these two movies came out, 1968, 1969, Brady Bunch comes out, so you would think that it was kind of a reboot of these two popular movies. But that's not true, because Brady Bunch was pitched in 1965, and one of those other movies was based on a real family that really existed and went on late-night TV shows with their 20 kids. It just so happened that there were three different separate entities in the late 1960s that figured out that what families really want to see are really big versions of families on TV and in the movies. And so within a span of a year, we had two big movies and a TV show with that premise. And none of them were connected. It just happened that all these people bit out these movies. And I love all of them, so you should watch them.
With Six You Get Egg Roll sounds vaguely racist. Is that line spoken by the owner of an Asian restaurant or something?
He's saying, I want all these kids in my family because when you order 6 of something, you get an egg roll. Oh, maybe it is racist because maybe he's repeating back what the owner of the Chinese restaurant said.
Because it's not with 6 you get an egg roll.
Right.
It's with 6
you get egg roll.
Yeah.
it's this ugly dialect that they put into the. It was a different time. Let's not get off on that subject.
That's actually George Carlin's first movie role is in this movie called The Six. I don't want to even say it anymore. Wait.
But the thing that they took away from that is not that America loves racist movie titles. It was. Remember that movie about a mixed family who both the parents were divorced and we rejected it back in 65 because we thought that America wouldn't care about a family that was the product of two divorces? This racist movie did slightly more business than I would have expected. So maybe we greenlight that.
Actually, that's exactly what happened. So Sherwood Schwartz, the guy who came up with the Brady Bunch, pitched that idea right after Gilligan's Island in 1965, and nobody wanted it. Then these two other movies came out in 1968, and he got his show greenlit right away because they did so well. And apparently people just were really into lots of kids on TV and in movies.
I think coming from like a writer's point of view, once you hear that premise, it's almost impossible to not love it because it gives you so many possibilities. Once you've decided that divorce is no longer a taboo thing, although I thought of the Brady Bunch, I thought their other spouses were dead.
None of them had divorces. These were all widows. They left it open on the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, all these dead wives.
But
anyways, once you get the idea of, okay, this is an America where the face of the family is changing and a lot of people have multiple marriages. So the idea of like merging two families under the household and the tensions that would create and the comedy situations that would create, and you've got so many people and so many different combinations you can play off of, your mind lights up with the possibilities. It's like one of those things like, I can't believe we're not doing this already once you hear it. So it's funny because it may have been that there was never a show about that premise in the 40-some years they've been making TV before that. But like once somebody pitches it, it's like irresistible. If it wasn't so incredibly dated, you could write shows around that premise forever. Because you've got this house full of people, and they're all at different stages of childhood,
yeah,
and all the different stages of life, and you know, there's all these different ways you can play with it.
Brown-haired boys and blonde-haired girls living under the same rooftop? That's madness. That's comedy gold.
Secretly having sex with each other.
Jeez.
The show The Shield, which was about a corrupt cop in L.A., and like the movie Training Day, obviously about a corrupt cop in L.A., when The Shield came on, like, a lot of people thought it was, we're going to do a crappy TV version of Training Day. And in fact, it wasn't that. They were both based off the same Rampart scandal, the scandal in L.A. where a bunch of the anti-gang task force turned out to be corrupt and doing all the stuff that they did in those movies, right, where they were stealing the money and all that. So there you've got a more straightforward example where, again, just people browsing the same newspaper can manifest itself in slightly different ways.
One of the families was based on real people, so I started off thinking, oh, this is three different, completely different people coming up with the same idea. But once you see somebody trot their 30 kids on TV, it's easy to see how...
Right, but the real family became famous for the same reason. The culture became fascinated with them for the same reason they became fascinated with the fictional version, right? Even though they're real people, they still got their moment in the spotlight because, for some reason, we were just enthralled with the idea. And maybe that's because it was an era when we started to see much smaller families, and so that suddenly seemed like more of a freak show type thing. Now, doing these reality shows about people because they've got nine kids or whatever, when in the 1920s that was considered a small family. You've only got nine kids because you need them to plow the fields for you.
Our new version of that is people who have octuplets or whatever, right? That's guaranteed fame.
Yeah.
If you want it. I can't believe that, thinking about how foreign that culture is to me, the fact that they would prefer to have people whose spouses died, that seems so morbid and depressing that all these kids had to watch one of their parents die. That was their version of MASH being about the Korean War instead of Vietnam. Obviously, divorce is happening, and that's a horrible reality of our time. So we'll kill off the first parent.
Well, to be fair, in the pilot of the Brady Bunch, the two actually conspired to kill each other's spouses so they could be together.
Darker show than I remember.
I keep saying, from a writer's point of view, like I've got 40 years of writing experience and now I'm lecturing everyone. I have two books I've written in my life, all right? So from a professional writer of fiction, it's more convenient to have them dead, because if they're divorced, you have to address the ex. The writers are going to want to have a situation where the ex shows up, and do they have to share custody, blah, blah, blah. In order to not have that complication, they've got to be dead. And then never mention it. That's the only way to handle it. Otherwise, you don't want to have to mess with, okay, so now do they get them on the weekend? Well, no, because they molested them. So they got the court to... They got the court to take them away. Like, see, once you go down that road, it just keeps getting more complicated, and it's cleaner to just kill them off. It's a terrible place to end the podcast. I don't know. Is there something else?
Are
we going to leave any of that in? I don't know.
I think that's exactly how the 80s would have handled the Brady Bunch, though. There would have been a divorce, and then there would have been a very special episode where...
Why don't we ever get visitation with Mom? Well...
Show us on this doll where... Poor Christy was like, I love the Brady Bunch, it's my favorite show, and you immediately you're immediately implied they were all having sex with each other, and then a double murder and child molestation.
Scream on it, yo, we at the weed gate waiting for Jake. We want 8 ravioli bags, 2 thirsty villains yelling bellyaches.
Heavyweight rhyme writers hitting the grass, that's the ripest. Pull out this kite from this white bitch.
All right, that was Parallel Thinking. Weird, huh? I don't believe in mind ghosts, as may have been implied in this episode, but it's just such a weird phenomenon that it does start to sound sort of mystical no matter how you describe it. You start to use words like phenomenon. The idea that an idea is larger and more resilient and more powerful than the people who have them. Again, I can't say that without sounding like a character in Inception, like totally just full of shit. But that's, I think, what we arrived at by the end there. The idea of Harry Potter or Dennis the Menace was more powerful than any one of the people who came up with the character and wrote the character. A character like him existed out there before he was invented by J.K. Rowling. Like, that idea was just out there. There's this book called Phantom Empire, Movies in the Mind of the 20th Century, by Jeffrey O'Brien, no relation, that reads the history of film as the dreams that are produced by our culture. You know, each movie is obviously its own big business with like lots of different arms and cynical people trying to, you know, make a buck. But when you step back and look at like the whole history of movies from a big historical perspective, you can view them as like hallucinations that our society is sort of conjuring up and using to sort of create meaning for itself. And I think that's what's left out of like a lot of the debate about like modern pop culture online and just in modern debates about culture. You know, we spend most of our time in right after a movie comes out, talking about the artistic merit and, you know, whether it was original. And that's just, I don't know, that seems really boring to me. Like just being like, yeah, good, bad, thumbs up, thumbs down, Rotten Tomatoes, even though I'm addicted to Rotten Tomatoes. It's just way more interesting to me to think about movies and art and pop culture in general as things, as like these dreams or visions that are sort of tapping into this great big cultural unconscious that is just, it's, I don't know, it seems equally as important as like the stuff you see on the news, right? It's the inner life of the country. The inner life of England was having a recurring dream about a boy wizard in the 90s forever, for whatever reason. And the American brain was stuck on the word creep in the 90s. And I think we spent some time talking about like, well, can you predict it? But I mean, that seems not even worth thinking about. But I do think it's interesting to kind of look back at that stuff and like sort of from a historical perspective and try and figure out what that tells us about the culture. The 80s and race, if you read the site, the 80s pop culture's perception of race relations is one of my favorite examples. But I don't know. We'll have to save that for another day because I'm already starting to sound like a film studies professor. And I don't want you to tune out before we get to footnotes. You heard Bros by Panda Bear off the album Person Pitch, which is just one of my favorite albums of the past 10 years. I don't know if that was because it's objectively great or if it was Parallel Thinking. I was just getting done digesting my first sort of deep dive into the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds and the Smile Sessions when I first heard this album about a year after it came out. And it seems to kind of play with a bunch of the textures of Brian Wilson recording sessions and integrate those into something new and modern and amazing. But yeah, I think I'm always about a year behind the curve of whatever wave music is riding at any given time. And this album feels like it was working through the Beach Boys in a really interesting way. So hopefully you guys still like that sound, and I don't know, you've all probably moved on to some other 60s band that is being digested now, the Partridge Family, maybe. And then we heard the song One off the album Supreme Clientele by the artist Ghostface Killa from the Wu-Tang Clan, who spent the late 90s and early 2000s making albums on which he just rapped obsessively about Iron Man and referred to himself as Tony Stark. I think there's a part in that song you can hear him refer to himself as Tony. So long before Hollywood figured out that we were
about to be obsessed with geek superheroes or any of the stuff that we talked about being sort of the logical cause of the Iron Man Sherlock wave. You know, his first album was called Iron Man and came out in 1996. This album came out in 2000. And Marvel was so bored and doing nothing with the property at that time that they took the time to sue Ghostface Killah for having, I think he used clips from the original Iron Man radio show on the album. But yeah, he was releasing albums called Iron Man and calling himself Tony Stark 9 years before Batman Begins sort of revived the whole superhero movie thing, and 12 years before the first Iron Man movie came out in 2008. And that's actually around when mainstream culture, I mean, I was when I was in high school, I had the poster for the Iron Man album, his first album, on my wall. But mainstream culture really started to appreciate him as like one of the great rappers of our generation around 2008. They finally were ready for a rapper who called himself Iron Man for no reason that makes sense. He was working through the vibrations out in the ether or whatever. I don't know. See, there's no good way to discuss it without sounding like you believe in ghosts. We'll stop there. Back next week with another episode that we haven't recorded yet, so I can't tell you what it's about yet, but it'll be good. Talk to you then.
Hey, yo, the devil planted fear inside the black babies. 50 cent sodas in the hood, they going crazy. Dead meat placed in the shelves, we eat coke, cause fast from the hog, y'all, and grow up. Hey, yo, crash through, break the glass, Tony with the goalie mask, that's the pass, heavy ice rolling, laying on the dash, love the grass, cauliflower hurting when I dump the trash, sour mash, served in every glass, up at the Wally Bass, sun splash, autograph blessing with your name slash, backdraft, 4 pounder screaming with the pearly ass, children fix the contrast, add the sound clashes, Mrs. Dad sprinkle with an icicle eyelash, ass cap a pentagram.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com. The wolf dead.